I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Leslie Dalla joins me now. He is the music director of the Vancouver Academy of Music Symphony Orchestra, an associate conductor of the at the Vancouver Opera, and the music director of the Vancouver Bach Choir. On Saturday, the 15th of December, 2012, at the Orpheum Theatre, they'll be presenting the John Adams oratorio El Niño. It's considered a messiah for the modern age and a wondrous poetic retelling of Christ's birth. I'll get Mr. Dalla to tell us about this concert, and we'll talk about being a conductor, music, and more. Leslie Dalla was also the music director of the Prince George Symphony, and he's been on the staff, the music staff of the Vancouver Opera since 1996. He recently conducted their production of West Side Story. Visit VancouverBachChoir.com for more information. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Leslie Dalla. Maestro, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So for people that don't know what the Vancouver Bach Choir is, it's a group of singers, right?
That's right.
100 or so?
Yep. Our numbers vary a little bit from concert to concert depending on people's availability, but we have about 120 members, so it's a large-scale choir. And its mandate, which is a little bit different from most choirs, is to perform the great music for chorus and symphonic orchestras. So most of our shows are done in participation with the Vancouver Symphony. Either they hire us in their season to do a few concerts, and then what El Niño is going to be is our presentation where we're hiring them to share the stage with us to put this great piece on.
I see. So we'll talk about El Niño in just a sec. Now, you're also part of the Vancouver Academy of Music.
Yeah,
That's like by the what do you call
Vanier
it?
Vanier Park.
Yeah, Vanier
Park.
Over
in Kits. Yeah, mm-hmm. And the Academy has been around for I think 42 years now. West of Toronto, it's the largest teaching institution of non-university, of course, of music as a conservatory, and it's a great place. It has turned out some major talents over the years. And they have three orchestras, and I'm the music director of the senior orchestra, and we play three concerts at the Orpheum every year. We just actually did, a week and a half ago, a performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, mm-hmm. in which we had the Vancouver Bach Choir participating, and also the soloists from the inaugural Yolanda Ferris Young Artist Program at Vancouver Opera. So I was able to kind of bring together the various organizations that I work with to participate in that one big concert.
Yeah, I know. The Academy of Music, that's you get all ages that go there, right?
That's right. That's right. I think, the youngest are probably, 3 years old who start Suzuki or ORF classes and that sort of thing. And then they grant university degrees, bachelor degrees and artist diplomas. So there are kids who are, in the 20s as well. And I think they have classes for adults, music appreciation, all kind of things. So, it's absolutely all ages.
So when we see a kid on television who's, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8, who's obviously a prodigy, they're born with musical talent, aren't they?
Yeah, the jury is out on that. There's no question that we are all predisposed to some things more than others. But the longer I'm at this, the more I realize that it's actually, it's hard work that gets you there. So even though a kid at age 3, 4, or 5, I mean, in that case, there has to be a natural disposition to that. But what turns, say, a moderate talent into a great one is just the sheer amount of hours and the amount of work that one is willing to put into that. Because nobody stays 4 or 5 for the rest of their lives, so people are, as the kid grows up, people are less interested and impressed if at age 8 they haven't developed, and the only way they're going to develop is by practicing and study and sort of that kind of work. So, to quote a famous example, I read a couple of years ago Long Long's autobiography, mm-hmm. and he's probably the most famous pianist on the planet right now, and the person who's inspired something like 100 million young Chinese kids to pick up the piano or something. I mean, it's staggering, the numbers. And his book was all about the fact that, he was basically forced at a very young age to be practicing a few hours a day. And as a kid, he hated it. I mean, he could play circles around most other people, but it wasn't like it was that great artistic inner voice that was coming out. It was simply, he was relegated to doing that. And you know, it's hard to know. There are some kids who I think just genuinely love it and sit down and can't be torn away from it, but probably most kids need a little bit of encouragement and some guidance over the years if they're going to stick with it.
Yeah. Now, as a kid, my grandmother wanted me to play the piano, and I didn't really like the teacher, so I left a bit of a contrarian streak in me. But recently, I was talking to a friend of mine who is musical, and I said, you know, because I've always been told that I have piano fingers, that perhaps I should take it up. Now, I'm 30, and she said I didn't have enough time to.
Oh my! Well, listen. I mean, you can take up anything at any time. It's having realistic expectations of what one wants to accomplish. But I'm a firm believer that music should be embraced at any time, at all times, at any age, because it's such a wonderful thing to do. It's great for the mind. It's great for one's emotional state. It's kind of like practicing yoga. It's a reflective time where one can really just zero in on. You know, making beautiful sounds there are books and books about what happens to our brains on music and all the kinds of things that are just going off like fireworks. I mean, it's something that's very, very healthy as well. So it's unfortunate that for some people, for sure, especially at the beginning, if the teacher-student relationship, as we all know, in everything in life is so terribly important. And if that doesn't line up at the beginning, it can turn people off over the course of a lifetime, which is very, very unfortunate. Another factor.
So when you're at the podium and you're conducting, what goes through your mind?
What doesn't, in a way? Conducting is a really fascinating thing in making music because, you know, you have to be absolutely in the present. For one watching, basically, what people see you do is, make some gestures that are supposed to reflect the tempo, the speed of a piece, and the general mood and that kind of thing. And while that's true, there's obviously a whole lot more going on. You could be conducting a 2-minute Christmas carol, or you could be conducting Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and, those things are worlds apart, and yet the process is sort of the same thing. What you're there to do is find a common sort of means for however many people you have performing to do this thing with sort of one vision, and whether that means, it means a lot of things. It means with sort of one speed or many speeds if it changes, with the kind of the quality of sound that you're looking for, and it's sort of bringing people together is what conducting is, and I never really studied it so much. I was a pianist and an organist and a violinist, and I was around a lot of different kinds of music making. I got into opera, and I just found that the longer I was with it, that I felt that what my real desire was to connect people more rather than just being at one instrument myself and making sounds from that. And that had always sort of been a passion, but I hadn't really pursued it. And so that's really, it's kind of like the one that binds things together.
Yeah, and so
I like to think of it.
Yeah, and so if you have one person playing the instrument and they're perhaps lagging behind, or the singer or something like that the performer is perhaps ahead of the orchestra, you can sort of bring them together at some point.
Yeah, I mean, in the most sort of basic sense, but usually if things are rehearsed and you've been working at it, then that can enter into the equation at times. But it's much more sort of, if I may, sort of profound and fundamental. It's about kind of speaking together and all of that. So while things might get out a little bit here and there, it has much more to do with also just concepts and a way of hearing things and listening. Actually, the best thing a conductor can do is encourage everybody to not just be involved in their own part, but to really listen. It's a community, because especially in an orchestra, you have strings, you have woodwinds, you have brass, percussion, you can have all kinds of other things, guest soloists either singing or playing an instrument, and the highest form of music making is where everybody is tuned into each other.
And the position of conductor, I mean, that's a powerful position. I mean, can you have a musician fired, say?
Oh, you know, well, that depends. I mean, you know, in the old days, conductors were sort of dictators, and, and they could pretty much do whatever. These days, that's not true anymore. I mean, with professional orchestras, there are unions that protect that kind of thing, and most conductors I know, too, it's not, you know, firing is like the most extreme thing that might happen. I mean, if you're not getting along with somebody, thankfully, we have language, we can talk, we can sit down and work things out. So conductors may seem very powerful, but you're also completely at the mercy of everybody in the room. So you might, you know, give a gesture and hear this magnificent sound in your head, but if the folks in front of you are not capable of producing that, then that can also be quite devastating. So it's certainly not as powerful as it looks. It's a very humbling.
So El Nino, that's the 15th of December, Saturday the 15th at the Orpheum. Now, John Adams, he's considered one of the, I guess, the greatest living composers nowadays, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so El Nino, this is the Canadian premiere, so this is the first time in Canada that this has been performed. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. About Adams and his music? I mean, he did the Nixon opera, didn't he?
That's right, yes.
What is it about this piece? I mean, it seems perfect for the time of year as well, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? Yeah.
Yes. He wrote the piece in 2000, and as he described it, it was kind of his response to Handel's Messiah. He always wanted to write sort of a big-scale oratorio that looked at the whole concept of Christ's nativity. And so this piece is very much sort of in keeping with that. It tells the story, but at the same time, it's a very much more modern sort of take on it. So it includes poetry, particularly Latin American poetry from the past couple of centuries, which focus on the concept of birth, on the female perspective of that, of the maternal. Mm-hmm. And El Niño, of course, means the child. And for most people, it'll conjure up, you know, the storms and
the weather,
a hurricane, exactly. but it really is about the child. And John Adams' frequent collaborator, the writer and director and producer Peter Sellers, was the one who helped him assemble the libretto, the texts for all of these various movements. And you know, there's one movement in the Nativity story. It talks about Christ being born in the time of King Herod, and how Herod had been warned that you know, there was going to be a birth that was going to basically revolutionize and dethrone him, so that he ordered a massacre of all children between the ages of, you know, well, 0 and 2 over a time, because he had to be sure he got the right one. And of course, you know, in the story in the Bible, Christ escaped and all of that. In the context of El Nino, it makes it very modern, because it refers to one of the bloodiest battles between the Mexicans and the Aztecs back in, I believe, the 1600s. And then fast forward to an event which happened in 1968 in Mexico City, in the same site where that very famous revolution had happened, where a number of students were basically gunned down by the authorities, and this is tied in to the story with Herod, and it's that particular movement is sung by the soprano soloist with the chorus in the background, and it's in Spanish, and a lot of the text just says, you know, if you're looking for evidence of this, don't bother, because it's all been erased. There's nothing in the archives, and apparently with this particular massacre, nobody reported on it on television and the news. It was as if it had never happened. And so, you know, the piece is in some ways very political. It's drawing attention to these facts, to these constant horrors that go on in our lifetime and from the past. So I think this is, you know, beyond the telling of that story, it's a very important work, which has been getting a number of performances throughout the world. It was co-commissioned by 5 major institutions. And it really sort of shocked me that it had never been done in Canada. And I'm a big John Adams fan, and I thought, well, let's see if we can make this happen here. So I'm really very excited and delighted that it took a lot of planning and a lot of organizing. But we are going to be presenting the Canadian premiere, and it's a major event of a very important piece.
Will his music, Adams's music, will that be performed, say, hundreds of years from now?
Well, it's hard to know what anything, you know, but it's the kind of question that people always like to ask because, you know, you can look at Beethoven and he died 200 years ago and, yeah. and we're still playing his music, or Bach, or Hildegard von Bingen, for example, who probably whose music laid in obscurity for centuries except for maybe in very small circles, and then, you know, back a couple of decades ago was a number one selling CD. It's hard to know what technology and everything will do. I think, basically, though, if you're asking if this is music of lasting importance, then without hesitation, I would say absolutely, because it has all of the various factors which constitute, you know, great works that last. But at the same time, it's very interesting that sometimes the best stuff takes time to be rediscovered. Or, I mean, if you look at somebody like Gustav Mahler, who, you know, these days, if you ask any classical musician, who was he an important composer, and they'd be crazy to say no, because you look at programming around the world of symphony orchestras, and to program a Mahler symphony is considered a major undertaking. But, you know, 20, 30 years after his death, he kind of faded, not completely, but nobody was really doing it, and it wasn't until the 50s and 60s when certain people like Leonard Bernstein and George Schulte were kind of, you know, bringing that programming back that now, you know, Mahler, 100 years after his death, is really right up there with some of those greats, but 40, 50 years after was not. So it's hard to know what fashions go in and out, and when you look at Italian opera, for example, 1800s, my God, there were so many people writing pieces, and they may have been incredibly successful in their day, made, you know, lots of money off their royalties, but we never, ever play those pieces anymore. And then there's other things which, like the debut of Carmen, of Bizet, you know, faded into obscurity after the first dozen performances, and now it's certainly among the top three performed operas in the world. I mean, it's impossible to know in some ways what will last, but I go back to the argument that Adams is a composer of great merit who really has developed his own style. His works also have very strong social and political implications, which I think will have a resonance that will carry beyond our own time.
When you're not working, do you listen to music?
Yeah, I do. Not so much because, I mean, these days I'm either in rehearsals a lot or in performances, so I find that it's nice to have some quiet. I've got two young kids as well, so when I'm at home, there's rarely any quiet. So I don't mind the quiet, but I like to listen to stuff, sometimes things that I'm working on. If it's something off the beaten path, I like Norah Jones, for example. That if I'm driving, I love to listen to Norah Jones because it's something that is completely different from anything I'm working on.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's a. Did you have an iPod?
I don't actually. I don't really like headphones. So I don't like to shut myself off in that world. I do that in my own way.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Vancouver?
I grew up in Toronto.
I see. Yeah. Is this a good place, Vancouver, to be in? If you're in the sort of work that you're in, the line of work that you're in.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, Vancouver's a great city, and there are some great musicians and great institutions in town, like the symphony, the opera, the recital society, the ballet, you know, the many choirs, things like the academy. So there is a lot going on. At the same time, we're shut off by our sort of geographic location. Unlike, say, being in Toronto, where you're close to Montreal and close to New York and Philadelphia, and all of those things are within reach, we don't really have that so much. And we've got Seattle close to us, but so as far as goings on here, they tend to be unnoticed. On the one hand, so there's not as much cross pollination, if you will. Of course, the internet and technology has changed that to a certain extent, but there's still, you know. It's. I think if one is established in the city, then it's a great thing for people who are up and coming. I think the opportunities are limited, and so for somebody who aspires to make a living as a musician in the arts in this city, it's a tougher slog now probably than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. But I think it's still possible if one has real passion and dedication and is willing to work hard. But, you know, we all know about all of the various funding cuts, and in our city in particular, Music Fest Vancouver just, you know, announced a week ago they were suspending operations for next year. The Playhouse, you know, last spring announced that it was ceasing operations. The idea of support is dwindling, and I think that simply has to do with the fact that people, you know, you mentioned that you learned piano as a kid. I think there are fewer and fewer kids who are introduced to music. It used to be part of the school curriculum, and now that's gone, and so it's, you know, people can't like something they don't know, and it can't seem foreign. So if one is brought up on all of these things, then it seems very natural, and not to say that everybody's going to go into music, but you have the likelihood that somebody will want to go to a concert if they know that, you know, this is a great piece, and, oh, I'd love to go and hear that live. And that's the climate which is really changing, and I find it actually quite terrifying, to be perfectly honest, because you can't just grow an audience overnight, and so when it seems that the audience is dwindling more and more, there's a lot of thinking to do on how to turn that around.
Yeah.
And whether one can even turn that around, because people are so used to getting things for free now as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you go on the internet, you want to hear something, you can probably hear it for free. I don't download music, but, you know, I understand you can download just about anything for free, which, again, if people can do that, then why would they pay, you know, whatever it is to go and see something or hear something? And so I fear that kind of thinking, because, you know, everybody wants something for free. But in order to put on a concert like El Nino, you know, just for us, that one show is around $150,000 for one evening's performance when you factor in all the costs of the orchestra, the soloists, the technical costs, the hall rental, the music rental, the preparation of, you know, whatever. It's terribly expensive. And if we're dealing with, you know, a public that's indifferent to that and, oh, well, you know, I can just listen to it for free on the internet or something, you can see how doomed we are.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of general thinking that I think is making it more and more difficult for the arts to thrive.
Yeah. See, I always wondered, what does the conductor do at intermission? Do you sit down?
I like to sit down. I don't know about, I can only speak for myself, but if you're standing up for an hour or so and, you know, you're working hard I definitely like to sit down. I like to drink water or some hot tea or something and just kind of chill. And you can't help but sort of reflect a little bit on what's happened. But the best thing is to just let it all go. Try and regroup, get your head together, and then, you know, focus on what's about to come up.
Yeah. Les, it's been fascinating talking today. It's been so much insight into what you do in music and the sort. I appreciate your time today.
Well, I appreciate being on the show. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The John Adams is El Nino. That's Saturday, the 15th of December at the Orpheum Theater. Visit VancouverBachChoir.com for more information. Leslie Dalla on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunder.